Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Whether it's a turtle who drags herself slowly to the sand lot where she digs the sandy nest she was born to dig and lay leathery eggs in, or whether it's salmon rocketing upstream toward pools that call, "Bring your eggs here and nowhere else in the world," whether it is turtle green ugliness and awkwardness, or the seething grace and guild of silky salmon, we are envious. Our wishes speak out right here, thirsty for a destiny like theirs, an absolute right choice to end all choices. Is it memory, we ask? Is it a smell they remember, or just what is it? Some kind of blueprint that makes them move, hot grain by grain, cold cascade above icy cascade, slipping through water's fingers, 100 miles inland from the easy, icy sea. And we also, in the company of our tribe, or perhaps alone, like the turtle on her wrinkled feet with the tapping nails, we also are going to travel. We say, let's be oblivious to all, save that we travel. And we say, when we reach the place, we'll know we are in the right spot somehow, like a breath entering a singer's chest that shapes itself for the song that is to follow. I have always experienced myself in this way as a seeker. Reading from the nakedness of the fathers. By the way, can you hear me all right in the back? How's the sound? Okay, good. The Nakedness of the Fathers is a book that comes out of my obsession with the Hebrew Bible, about 10 years worth of obsession. I was raised third generation atheist socialist Jew. That's a special kind of Jew. But because, you know, my own religious training consisted of being told that religion was the opiate of the people. But on the other hand, our family was clearly Jewish and nothing else. And since one must always rebel against one's upbringing, I go through the world seeking my God. And the Nakedness of the Fathers is partly a result of that search. I try in this work to see what is in the compelling stories of the Bible without the varnish of pious commentary that has overlaid them for 2,000 years or thereabouts. I try to see what's in the stories as they relate to my personal and family history and as they relate to the history that we are living through. I experience the Bible as an extremely contemporary work. I think it's Faulkner who says, "The past is not dead, it is not even past." In the beginning, the being. In the beginning, the being created heaven and earth. The being created light. The being divided the light from the darkness. It was evening and morning, the first day. The being created the firmament to divide the waters from the waters, the second day. The being created grass, herb yielding seed, and fruit tree yielding fruit, whose seed is inside of itself, the third day. The being created lights in the firmament, created the sun and moon, and made the stars also, the fourth day. The being created great whales, created sea creatures, winged creatures, and told them to multiply, the fifth day. The being told the earth to bring forth animals, and so it gave birth to all beasts and creeping creatures, the sixth day. Each day, the being saw what was made, that it was good, was very good. The being created the world without language, without pronoun. Then the being created man and woman in the image, the distant image of itself, and blessed them. I like the idea that English provides us with a word, being. Being, which means both, which suggests both the idea of a being, a person, and the idea, the abstract noun, being, existence, all of existence, as a way to describe God. The term is paradoxical, and it is my belief that that we cannot even begin to attempt to describe God without paradox. I am and am not a Jew. I am a Jew in the sense that every drop of blood in my veins is Jewish, or so I figuratively presume, although Jews have been a mixed multitude since they left Egypt. I'm a Jew because my parents are. So, naturally, is every thought in my head, my habits of thinking, my moral impulses and burden of chronic guilt, my sense of humor, if any, my confrontational and adversarial inclinations. They say a Jew is somebody who loves to argue, especially with God and other Jews. My laughter and tears are Jewish laughter and tears. What else could they be? My ancestors are Russian Jewish ancestors. The shtetl mud is hardly shaken from my roots. In the 1880s, when the great pogroms swept Russia and Eastern Europe, it was me they hated and wanted to kill. Me, an innocent girl in my babushka throwing grain to the chickens. In 1944, it could have been me trembling, my long nose no longer in a book, wetting myself in a railroad car a few kilometers out of Budapest, or among the soft, stacked bodies like speechless tongues in the mouth of a ravine at Baba Yar. Here is my violin, hidden in a closet of the Warsaw apartment, kicked to splinters by a soldier's boot, going up in flames. And I have fantastically escaped and can breathe air, enjoy freedom by merest chance. No way I can be anything else. Can't be a Buddhist like Allen Ginsberg, who anyway gets more and more rabbinical. Can't be a Sufi like Doris Lessing. When I stand before a classroom to discuss a Shakespeare sonnet, who stands inside me? Isn't it a long row of rabbis waving their bony index fingers, cantankerous and didactic, analyzing a bit of Aramaic phrasing? When I march in a peace demonstration, the prophet Isaiah goes in front of me. Beat your swords into plowshares, he shouts. Do not hurt or destroy. And I hurry to step and chant alongside him. Could I despise the drops of blood in my body? To deny my Judaism would be like denying the gift of life, the reality of sorrow, the pleasures of learning and teaching. To reject Judaism would be to surrender an idea of justice inseparable from compassion. But I'm not a Jew. I can't be a Jew because Judaism repels me as a woman. To the rest of the world, the Jew is marginal. But to Judaism, I am marginal. Am a woman, unclean. Am Eve. Or worse, am Lilith, am illiterate. Not mine the arguments of Talmud, not mine the centuries of ecstatic study, the questions and answers twining minutely like vines around the living word. Not mine the Kabbalah, the letters of the Hebrew alphabet dancing as if they were attributes of God. These texts, like the law and the prophets, are not me. For 1,000 years and longer, I am not permitted to discuss sacred writing. I am not permitted to be a scholar. I am not given access to the texts, although my very bones command me to go and study. It is said, woe to the father whose children are girls. It is said, whoever teaches his daughter Torah teaches her obscenity. It is said, the voice of woman leads to lewdness. I am told to light candles in honor of the Holy Word, revere my husband, raise my children, cook and clean, and manage a joyous household in the name of these texts. What right have I to comment? None. 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 What calls me to do it? I have no answer but the drops of my blood that say, try. Most of this book is prose interrupted by poems, like the Bible itself. And I'll read some poems and then some prose. The opinion of Hagar. As you know, the first romantic triangle in the Bible consists of Father Abraham, the first patriarch, Sarah, his wife, and Hagar, the bondservant. Sarah is beautiful but barren, and she sends her slave in to her husband to get a child, who then would be legally Sarah's. This is not an act of altruism. This is what we know today as surrogate motherhood. You see, this isn't a new invention. You can read about it in the law codes of Hammurabi, actually. Of course, it doesn't work out. Sarah and Hagar become rivals, and when Sarah has her own son, she gets Hagar and Ishmael cast out. Sarah, with her son Isaac, becomes the ancestress of the Hebrew people. Hagar and her son Ishmael becomes the ancestress of the Arab people. So what you are reading about in the headlines today in the Middle East begins right at this point in Genesis 21:9, where Sarah said unto Abraham, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even Isaac." That's one epigraph. And the other epigraph is from W.H. Auden. "And the living nations wait, each sequestered in its hate." The opinion of Hagar. "I have no opinion. I am an Egyptian woman. They sold me and made me her slave. Like everyone else, I was in love with her beauty. She pretended to care for me. Forget about our nationalities. Forget about social rank," she would say. "We are women together. That is what matters, Hagar." She used me. When she couldn't have a child herself, she made me sleep with her husband, that old creepy man. When my son was born, she was yellow with jealousy of my round breasts, of my strong, healthy boy. Finally, she too had a son. What a laugh, a thin stick of a baby who whined and spit up his food all day. Just what you would expect from those threadbare sacks of parents. But that was the end of me. She threw me away like garbage. Hagar, she jeered. Hagar, the stranger. You see how humble I am. My son is another story. Not like me. He is free and courageous. A wild ass of a man. He can read and write. He can run a printing press. He can shoot an AK-47. I call him Ishmael. I whisper to him, "Fight to your dying breath." But I still wonder, why could she not love me? We were women together. A little footnote to this poem. As you can imagine, there are many, many women today writing Midrash, and I collect them. I collect work in this area. And I have not seen any piece by a woman on the Sarah Hagar story that does not fantasize a reunion. Just as simultaneously in Israel, though you will not read about it or hear about it in the media, because of course what women do doesn't matter, but there have been organizations of Jewish and Palestinian women working together for peace for years and years before the handshake. The first prophetess and poet in our tradition is Miriam. Miriam makes three little cameo appearances in the Exodus story. She's a young girl when her baby brother Moses is left in the River Nile to escape the doom that Pharaoh has pronounced on all Hebrew baby boys. They are all supposed to be killed. And Miriam is there when Pharaoh's daughter finds the baby, and she's there making sure it all comes out all right. This is a story I particularly like right at the beginning of Exodus, because it's a story in which there is a virtual collaboration or conspiracy of women. The midwives, Moses' mother, his sister, Pharaoh's daughter, and all Pharaoh's attendants, they all work together against the decree of Pharaoh. They are all transgressors. They are all lawbreakers. They defy the law of the Father to save a life, to save a baby's life. That's nice. Second time Miriam appears is after the Israelites have escaped slavery in Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, Pharaoh's army has followed them and been drowned, and Miriam, who is now called the prophetess, leads the women in a song and dance of triumph on the far shore. Third episode, not so many people know this one, is in the middle of the wanderings in the desert. Miriam and Aaron, Moses' sister and brother, question his leadership, saying, "Has God spoken only to Moses? Aren't we prophets also?" And you can read this as a story about how, as we know, it sometimes occurs that the liberator becomes the dictator. As a result of this challenge to Moses' leadership, Miriam, but not Aaron, gets struck with leprosy for a week. That's divine justice for you. And the very next thing that happens, shortly after that, she dies in the desert. And the very next thing that happens after that is there's a drought. Now, if you read Bible the way I do, you go, ding. Part of what I am interested in is the whole question of what has been erased. What was there in the tradition while it was still oral tradition? What was there before the power of woman was lost, was subdued? If you read this way, you remember that Miriam has been associated with water in her two previous appearances, that her name means bitter sea. Might is the yam part is like the yam in Tiamat, the Babylonian goddess. Who was she? Ilona Pardes, in a book on counter traditions in the Bible, speculates that all the women in the Exodus story are splintered versions of the protectress goddess Isis. And she has a whole theory for that. I am inclined to associate Miriam with a particular Canaanite goddess and not who is associated with the conquest of water. And in fact, there also exists a set of stories that don't get into writing until the Middle Ages about Miriam's well, which is supposed to have followed the Israelites around in the wilderness as long as Miriam was alive and then dried up at her death. And that's how the rabbis accounted for that drought. Very interesting. The Songs of Miriam. I'm a young girl. My period's not started yet. Up to my waist in Nile water, I push the baby basket through the bulrushes onto the beach. Come on, I say to myself, let's go. And they see it and come running. My brother cries like a kitten in the arms of that princess. Her painted face fills with the joy of disobedience, which is the life of joy. When she is hooked, I walk out of the river, bowing and bowing. I am Miriam, daughter of Israel. We gather the limbs, we gather the limbs, we gather the limbs of the child. We sing to the river, we bathe in the river, we save the life of the child. If you listen to me once, you will have to go on listening to me. I am Miriam the prophetess, Miriam who makes the songs. I lead the women in a sacred circle, shaking our breasts and hips with timbrels and with dances, singing how we got over. O God of hosts, the horse and his rider have you thrown into the sea. That is my song, my music, my unended and unfinished prophecy. The horse was captivity and its rider, fear. O God of hosts, never again bondage, never again terror, O God of hosts. Call me rebelliousness, call me the bitter sea. I peel the skin off myself in strips. I am going to die in the sand. Miriam the leprous, Miriam the hag, Miriam the cackling one. What did I have but a voice to announce liberty? No magic tricks, no miracles, no history, no stick or stone of law. You who believe that God speaks only through Moses, bury me in the desert. I curse you with drought. I curse you with spiritual dryness. But you who remember my music, you will feel me under your footsoles like cool groundwater under porous stone. Follow me, follow my drum, follow my drum, follow my drum. Follow me, follow my drum, follow my drum. I, who am maiden, woman, and crone. I, who am Miriam. I'll read a little bit of the piece on the Book of Esther. It's an instance of how I like to splice personal history and biblical history. They tell the story of Esther to children. It's a folk tale, horror wrapped up as entertainment, threat of annihilation averted. Once a year, we imagine the victory of the powerless as a game. Casting lots, take a chance on Mordecai, and watch those plot twists. Number one wife Vashti demoted for discipline problems. Esther wins Miss Persia contest to replace her. Sexy Jewess announces, "If I perish, I perish," and reveals secret of birth. Beauty queen becomes savior of people. Evil scheme foiled, wicked Haman impaled on his own scaffold. A poke at the principalities and powers. King Ahasuerus, drunk again, countermands earlier order to kill all Jews. The story is good for thousands of years, for we have scrolled forward in history into the normal life of empires, where helpless people are crushed as a matter of course, for them to hate us and want us destroyed. I'm skipping a bit. Mordecai changes Esther's life, introduces her to Jewish identity. In a similar way, my grandfather changes me. I am in his lap, getting close to the smells of pipe tobacco and wool, enthroned where so often I have heard him tell the story of the man who traveled from place to place. I am his Shana Madala, his pretty little girl, his one grandchild. He gives me lifesavers on the sly. He glows at me through his glasses. He makes me show how I can already read. He is teaching me to play checkers. It is Saturday. All week I have been in kindergarten. We learned right away to salute the flag. Now we are learning about democracy and elections. I ask my grandfather who he will vote for in the next election, knowing he will say Roosevelt, since everyone I know will vote for Roosevelt, so we can finish beating Hitler and the Japs. I rub my cheek against his scratchy cardigan. He says nothing. Then he says he is not going to vote. I am shocked. I sit up tall in his lap to give him a lesson about democracy. My grandfather's arms are around me, but he looks away. Something changes in the air. For a moment, I believe I have won the argument. Then he says that he will not vote for any president because no president will save the Jews in Europe. It is the first time I have heard that phrase. The Jews in Europe. A quarter century later, my mother describes a game they had when she was a young girl. She would come into the house and rush at her father with her arms wide, laughing as if to embrace him. He would run around the apartment, around the furniture, as if he were afraid. She would chase after him, and he would yell, "Oi, oi, mishlugta de yidden! Help, help, they're killing the Jews." It would be false to say that I am being shoved forward in a line of human skeletons outside the city of Kiev. Embracing to my chest a book of poetry which, although I am only five, I can already read. False to say that I'm huddled in a sewer under the city of Warsaw frowning over a map. I am not in the woods checking a rifle. No, it is a Saturday afternoon in September 1944 in Borough Park, Brooklyn, America. I am the most ignorant possible American child in my pinafore, sitting on the knees of my socialist grandfather, just outside the kitchen, where my mother and grandmother drink hot tea in glasses, the sugar settled in a sweet dissolving heap at the bottom. It would be correct to say that the air around me has changed, has acquired a greater transparency. It is like stories of time travel, where you find yourself unwarned in some alternative universe with new laws of physics. I have no idea what my grandfather means. At the same time, I understand perfectly. I have instantly acquired awareness of a global grief. An initiation, a kindness without walls, a bitterness without floor. The familiar Brooklyn apartment seems for that instant to have dissolved. An instant and permanent canker on a child's budding patriotism. He squeezes my shoulder. The terrible danger that he will cry is past. I jump from his lap and go into the kitchen for tea. Now I understand that inside is always different from outside, reality from appearance, depth from surface. Don't expect me to forget. I'll close with a poem, which is the last piece in the book. The next to the last piece is about the death of God, and it's called Intensive Care, because of course that's where the death of God takes place. And, you know, lots of television cameras and so forth. But there are two women reporters, and they go to the cafeteria to talk about this, and they decide that he's not dying, he's not dead, it's just media hype, but he does appear to be in pain, and they figure out that he's not dying. He's only pregnant. And we do know that that the being known as God the Father in the West swallowed God the Mother in prehistory. So I figure, you know, she's still inside there. And God is, of course, pregnant. And we are awaiting the rebirth of that other aspect of the being, whom we have repressed for something like 4,000 years. This is called A Prayer to the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is very important in Kabbalah as the feminine aspect of God. And the word in Hebrew means dwelling and stands for that aspect of God which is not remote and infinite and eternal but dwells among us. In Kabbalah, there is a set of stories according to which God and his Shekhinah were divided at the moment of creation, and the purpose of human history is to bring them back together, which we help to do whenever we do good deeds. Come be our mother, we are your young ones. Come be our bride, we are your lover. Come be our dwelling, we are your inhabitants. Come be our game, we are your players. Come be our punishment, we are your sinners. Come be our ocean, we are your swimmers. Come be our victory, we are your army. Come be our laughter, we are your story. Come be our Shekhinah, we are your glory. We believe that you live. Though you delay, we believe you will certainly come. When the transformation happens, as it must, when we remember, When she wakes from her long repose in us, when she wipes the nightmare of history from her eyes, when she returns from exile, when she utters her voice in the streets, in the opening of the gates, when she enters the modern world, when she crosses the land, shaking her breasts and hips with timbrels and with dances, magnified and sanctified, exalted and honored, blessed and glorified. When she causes tyranny to vanish, when she and he meet, when they behold each other face to face, when they become naked and not ashamed, on that day will our God be one, and their name one. Shekhinah, bless us and keep us. Shekhinah, shine your face on us. Shekhinah, turn your countenance to us and give us peace. Thank you.